Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Tehran to speak with one of the few Western journalists in Iran, Ali Arouzi, NBC's bureau chief in Tehran. We will discuss the outcome of Friday's presidential election that surprised American analysts who predicted a hardline hand-picked successor to Ahmadinejad would win. We will look into whether this is a victory for wisdom and moderation over extremism and ill temper, as the winner, Hassan Rouhani, has described it. Then we will get a further analysis of whether the surprise win in Iran is a change in atmospherics or substance from Rasul Nafisi, who is a Middle East expert who has written about the Pasdaran, the guardians of the revolution. Today, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps said on their website that we announce our comprehensive readiness for interaction and cooperation with the next administration. We will discuss what changes in Iran's foreign and domestic policies are likely, given that the president does not control foreign policy but instead presides over a troubled economy. Then finally, following Bill Clinton's remark that Obama could look like a total wuss if he does not intervene in Syria, we will assess the impact of the White House's decision to arm the Syrian opposition after acknowledging that the Assad regime had crossed its red line over the use of chemical weapons. Rafif Jujati, the English-language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordinating Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition, joins us to discuss what this change in U.S. policy might mean on the battlefield and at the negotiating table. And apparently we're having who is on? Ali? Ali, are you there? Ali?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, thank you so much. We're just having some problems getting through to you. So you were just, let me just introduce you then. Ali Arouzi is joining us from Tehran, Iran. He's the NBC bureau chief in Tehran, one of the few Western journalists operating in the country. He was born in Iran, and he and his family moved to London when Islamic revolutionaries deposed the Shah. He first returned to his native country in 2004 to report on the massive Iranian earthquake and has since become one of NBC's chief correspondents on Iranian affairs, and he has just covered a press conference at the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khamenei, where the new president paid his respects. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Arouzi. Ali?
Thank you, Ian.
So tell me... So tell me, what are we talking about here in terms of this new president who's caught everybody by surprise, including American analysts who basically said that this would be a hand-picked, hard-line successor and that the election is rigged? It does seem, with 72% of the Iranian people participating and the show of support from people in the streets wearing purple, the color of this candidate, and they seem quite festive. What is your take, being there on the ground? Is this a change in atmospherics or a change in substance?
Well, it's a very good question, Ian. I mean, he's got a very tough road ahead of him. And I think all the Iranian people are waiting to see whether there's going to be a major shift, a tangible shift in policy, or just a softening in tone. He's certainly been very welcoming to opening up the doors to the West. He's talked about negotiating with the United States that Iran needs to do this to come out of this war. He's spoken about better civil liberties and more social freedom for the Iranian people. Now we have to see if he can deliver on that. It's going to be an uphill struggle. He's going to have a lot of people against him that are very conservative in the country. But having said all of that, he's got a massive popular vote. There's no doubt about that. I don't think the numbers would fudge. The votes that each candidate got added up, it made sense. It equated to the person they were. So he's got a very, very popular mandate from the people. He's got this mandate because he's got the backing of a former President Khatami, who is the leading reformist in the country, also the backing of Hashemi Hassan, the political survivor Islamic system. So he's got some big guns behind him, and he's got the popular vote behind him. Now we have to see if he can deliver on his promises. Ian?
So, Ali, explain to us the pre-election maneuvering here, where the reformist candidate dropped out at the urging of the former president. Hotami, and also Rafsanjani, who wasn't allowed to run, also endorsed Hassan Rouhani. So, what were those manoeuvres about?
Well, they were trying to get over the hump. Rouhani is not a reformist. He's a centrist, but he has the backing for the reformists. There was only one reformist running in this race, Mohammad Reza Aref, who dropped out. He didn't back Rouhani, but it was obvious he dropped out in favor because of what people had told him. The conservatives, who had five candidates, couldn't rally behind one person. So it shows us that the reformist camp was organized. What was also very telling is that the Muslims of the Ayatollah Khomeini, a lot of supporters for Rouhani had come out there today wearing green bracelets showing a picture, and they were all chanting, "Rouhani, don't forget Aref, the reformist candidate who dropped out in favor of him." So basically they were saying, "We voted for you because Aref dropped out in your favor." So it shows how important that reformist vote was for him. And it's somewhere as sensitive as the Mausoleum of Imam Khomeini, they were still making these chants. Another thing that was also very telling in this election was about 35 million people out of 6 million eligible voters went to the ballot box. Mr. Rouhani got just over 18 million votes, and the five conservative candidates combined got just under 18 votes. So it was pretty much split between Rouhani and five conservative candidates, which shows a country somewhat divided in what they want, how they want to be received in the outside world. That's not to say that there's any notion of some sort of Persian Arab spring happening, not by any stretch of the imagination, but it shows a difference in how people want the country to receive and run. Yeah.
And Ali Arouzi, my understanding is that the people were also, back in 2009, of course, they chanted death to the dictator after they felt that the election was stolen. This time around, my understanding that some of the chants were, "Thank you, dictator, for allowing a fair vote." Did you witness that?
I didn't hear any of that, but there were no, the chants were going outside were nothing like 2009. The only chants that made you realize that, you know, things resonating from 2009 were, more people were calling for the release of Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karabi, the two presidential reforms candidates in 2009 that had been under very, very strict house arrest for the last few years. People were calling for their release, which is going to be a very sensitive issue, Mr. Rouhani. I believe, you know, everybody's waiting on tender hooks to see if he will be released and what the reaction from the general public will be. Yeah?
So, again, I'm speaking with Ali Arouzi, who is the NBC bureau chief in Tehran, Iran, one of the few Western journalists operating in the country. He has just covered a press conference at the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, where the new president paid his respects. And now, as you mentioned, the two leaders that are under house arrest, that would be, I take it, a lot of the moderate voters. And you pointed out, Ali, that Hassan Rouhani is a centrist as opposed to a moderate or a reformer, but he was supported by the reformers in the form of former presidents Rafsanjani and Hotami. But I take it that the followers, those who voted for him, in the hope that there will be reform, and much of what he has said so far must be encouraging to them when he talks about his victory being a victory for wisdom and moderation over extremism and ill temper. Are the Green Movement people who are now waving purple as well as green, are they waiting to see whether these two leaders under house arrest will be released? Is that a pledge and a promise that Rouhani made?
Not a pledge or a promise he made, but he's going to be under a lot of pressure to make that happen. Every rally he had leading up to this election, people were chanting about their release. It was done on the streets last night when there was a celebration carnival atmosphere on the streets of Tehran. People were also calling for their release. Now, he hasn't directly addressed this issue, but he's certainly going to be under a lot of pressure to get this done. And also, let's not forget that former President Khatami and Rafsanjani also backed Mousavi and Karoubi 4 years ago, so they will probably be applying pressure from behind the scenes as well. Ian?
And Ali, since the new president basically doesn't have any control over the national security, that still remains the portfolio of the supreme leader, but he does have authority over a very troubled economy, and he's in a country now that is certainly where the supreme leader is more powerful, the Revolutionary Guards are more influential, and the Conservatives are more in control than when Khatami, who backs him, was in charge. What are his prospects of turning the economy around without getting an easing of Western sanctions, which, after all, is not his portfolio?
Without easing of sanctions, he's going to have a really tough uphill struggle to get this done. I mean, one of the reasons the economy is in bad condition was that it was mismanaged by the former government. There's no doubt about the subsidy reforms didn't work. These handouts that he handed to the poor classes of Iranians in the South created a charity economy. So there was certainly some mismanagement there, but you know, the sanctions have certainly had an effect. It caused hyperinflation. The rial, the Iranian currency, has devalued by about 70%. So he's going to have to tread a careful line. It's a combination of trying to remanage the economy properly, make proper fiscal decisions, as well as trying to loosen the sanctions, because you know Iran is dependent on oil sales, and with the sanctions that are so tough on Iran, they're not selling their oil, and that's what's really choking it off from the world economy. Yeah.
So Ali Arouzi, how is he then going to deal with the big issue, which is a foreign policy issue, and that is the P5 plus one talks, the nuclear issue, and you know, if he doesn't have the authority to negotiate on that level, what can he do if that is the main problem, the sanctions?
Well, he doesn't have the authority to write off on a final decision, but he can certainly set the tone in talks. He can certainly steer the supreme leader the decision-making in a certain way that he thinks would benefit the country. Let's not forget, when he was chief nuclear negotiator under Khatami's presidency, he got on very well with Western diplomats, Western powers, and that was the first time Iran suspended uranium enrichment whilst with nuclear negotiator. When President Ahmadinejad came to power in 2005, they fired that whole program up again. And that was some of the criticism that had been aimed at Rouhani from the hardliners, saying that, you know, you sold Iran's nuclear rights down the river. But he obviously had some mandate to make the deal he did. Now that he's president, and he'll probably appoint the chief nuclear negotiator, they're certainly going to change the tone in talks. And I think Western diplomats have also realized that. Yeah.
Well, I understand that his appeal is quite broad, that Hassan Rouhani did win in the small towns and villages where the people are much more conservative than they are in the larger cities, and he is, after all, a cleric. But he also clearly won in the cities with the educated classes, the reformists, for the want of a better description. So he has he seems to have a pretty broad base. Did he when you say he got on well with the supreme leader? What will that negotiating, what will that involve? Because my understanding is the supreme leader and his son, who's quite influential as well, is fairly much in t- tight with the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and they came out on their website today with a rather bland statement that we announce our comprehensive readiness for interaction and cooperation with the next administration. So given the sort of siege mentality that apparently exists with the IRGC and with the Supreme Leader and the situation in Syria in flux, what is your sense then of whether the popular mandate of this new leader will give him some wind at his back?
Well, look, like I said, he'll definitely set the tone. He has popular support, but as we all know, the buck stops with the Supreme Leader. And if he feels things are not going in the right direction to preserve the Islamic Republic, he certainly will change the course of negotiations and talks. That's a very important thing. I mean, let's not forget the Iranian constitution clearly states that the Supreme Leader is the most powerful man in the land, and the second most powerful is the president. So from that, everybody should understand how the power structure here works. Now, having said all of that, Iran is under immense pressure, has been under the last 3 years. And with Mr. Rouhani coming in and getting this massive vote, with the police on the streets, the authorities being fairly soft with everybody outside, I sense a change in the winds coming. But in the opaque world of Iranian politics, it can be predictably unpredictable. Ian?
Well, Ali Aruzi, I thank you so much for joining us from Tehran and for filling us in on what is happening there right now. And I very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ali Aruzi, who is the NBC bureau chief in Tehran, Iran. He's one of the few Western journalists operating out of the country, and he was born in Iran. He and his family moved to London when the Islamic revolutionaries deposed the Shah, and he first returned to his native country in 2004 to report on the massive Iranian earthquake and has since become one of NBC's chief correspondents on Iranian affairs. He has just covered a press conference at the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, where the new president paid his respects. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with a further analysis of this surprise win in Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rasul Nafisi, who is an academic and Middle East expert. His latest book is The Rise of the Pasdaran, a monograph on the social, political, and economic roles of the Guardians of the Revolution in Iran. And his most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rasul Nafisi.
Hello, Ian.
So I know you had difficulty hearing our guest from Tehran, and I'm sure our audience did, and I'm sorry about the connection, but that was the only one we could get. It's very difficult to get through. We were trying for a while, and we weren't even sure we were going to get through. So were not able to decipher much of what Ali Aruzi had to say?
Unfortunately not, no. I could hear your questions quite well, but not his comments. I'm sorry.
Well, he seemed to think that there was a real change underway, that there's tremendous enthusiasm amongst the public, and that even though the new president is a centrist as opposed to a reformer, Hassan Rouhani has, of course, his victory was enabled by the backing of the former president, Hotami, and the former president, Rafsanjani. And he felt that there was a considerable influence coming from those quarters and that he would, even though he doesn't control the foreign policy portfolio, and indeed the supreme leader is the ultimate has the ultimate say in any case, he felt that he would still have a considerable amount of influence and leverage over the future direction of the country. So that's an overall description of what he was telling us.
Great.
So what's your response to that? Do you think
Actually, I think that Mr. Rouhani will have a say in foreign policy, especially considering the nuclear issues with the West, because of his very rich experience in the field. And the fact that both camps trust him, Ayatollah Khamenei certainly trusts him. He's his representative. He's a close ally, and they know each other very well. And so do the reformists. And this is the type of person that also can get along with the Western countries. He can speak their language, understand their culture. He's been with them before. He's got a track record with them. Actually, I think Rouhani will have a lot of say in terms of nuclear issues, and he will be on the side of negotiation, compromise, give and take, the opposite of Ahmadinejad and Jalili. So actually I think he will have a lot of success in convincing Ayatollah Khamenei to change his style, especially if you look at this election. It was a vote on the hardliner versus the centrist, a vote on the people who advocated going all the way for the nuclear enrichment and so forth, against those people who said, look, like Rouhani, who said, well, this is good to have centrifuges, but it is good to have, you know, bread on the table too. So it was quite a vote against the nuclear policy of Jalili Khamenei. So I think Rouhani will have a mandate. The only thing is how he will be able to channel this mandate into a parlance of negotiation with Ayatollah Khamenei, and probably he can do that because they are both clerics. But he is very articulate. He knows laws, and more than that, I think one thing that goes for Mr. Rouhani is that if you watch his videos that he made for the election, he really did not say anything about Ayatollah Khamenei or his support. He actually mentioned the names of Rafsanjani and Khatami many times. So he is really an independent in a way compared to other people in the group. Now, one thing about Rouhani that makes him, again, a powerful candidate for a successful negotiation with the Western countries is his book. He wrote a thick book on his experience in nuclear negotiation. And I had the chance to take a look at the book, and he seems to be quite a reasonable, logical individual. And I invest a lot of hope in that department. But when it comes to domestic front, I'm not quite sure that he can do much because the economy is in shambles, the country is broke, and frankly, I don't think the United States Congress will get along to help him out. Because it is the predominant ideology today in the Congress is to bring Iran to its knees, and basically maybe they are not very happy either with the election of a centrist. They would have been much happier probably with the Ahmadinejad type. So what I am really worried about today is how the United States Congress will react to Rouhani than how the various factions in Iran will or will not cooperate with Rouhani.
Well, fortunately, the U.S. Congress doesn't completely control foreign policy, and the President, Obama, has some room to maneuver. Now, he did send an olive branch to Iran when he first came into office, and he was pretty much spurned by the Iranian side. I suppose that's not likely to happen with this new leadership. Surely, if indeed, as Ali Arousi was telling us a minute ago from Tehran, that when he was the nuclear negotiator, he suspended enrichment, which was the last time that happened, and that perhaps he's a lot more flexible. And even though the Ayatollah Khamenei has the ultimate say, the supreme leader, he feels that this new leader has quite a bit of support in the public. And the fact that he got more votes than all of the hardliners combined, maybe that is a message that the hardliners and the IRGC have to take notice of.
Absolutely. I understand that actually the ultimate arbitrator in the United States is the president. But what I'm saying is, looking at the number of sanctions on Iran that passed, like one after the other by the Congress, and also the structure of the Congress today, which is entirely anti-Iranian, and also the attitude of Netanyahu that was spelled out, and he basically didn't seem to care much about the election of a centrist and all that. If you combine these, you feel that the United States would not be quite receptive to a new moderate type of guy. This is my fear, frankly. I hope I'm wrong. Secondly, if you look at the role that IRGC and other people played in this election, it is quite interesting because they were shut up. They did not say anything, unlike in the previous election that they showed their clear support for Ahmadinejad. And the important thing is, actually, to my estimate, Rouhani is a much more effective leader compared to Charoubi or Mousavi, who are under house arrest, because of his connections, because of his tremendously rich and extended connections, and also his experience. So, in fact, he will be a more important rival to the type of IRGC people. And he said that. He said, look, I'm not a military man. I'm a legalist. I'm a lawyer, sort of. So he basically emphasized the role of law against the rule of military type individuals and enforcing their will on the economy and everything else. So I was pretty surprised that IRGC was kind of quiet, and I'm sure that they were told to stay quiet because Ayatollah Khamenei does not want another uprising in Iran, and also understand the vehemence of the present situation. And also, as I said before, Rouhani is not really far from the office of the leader. So, to my estimate, Rouhani will be a powerful leader inside. Will have a lot of say on foreign policy, but a lot depends on the U.S. Congress. A lot depends on the first year of Rouhani and how much he can produce in terms of negotiations, in terms of getting the economy going, and so forth. So this first year is quite crucial, not only for Rouhani, but also for the reformist movement and those people who hope to be able to move this archaic system a little bit forward and make it a little bit more palatable to the taste of the young people, liberals, women, and intellectuals.
Again, I'm speaking with Rasul Nafisi, who's an academic and Middle East expert. His latest book is The Rise of Pasdaran, a monograph on the social, political, and economic roles of the Guardians of the Revolution in Iran. And his most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. And we were speaking earlier with Ali Arouzi in Tehran, the NBC's bureau chief there, and he said that the release of the of house arrest of Mousavi and Karoubi, the two reformist leaders that have been held in house arrest since 2011, will of course be a key indicator of the direction. And many of these those who voted for the new leader are looking at Rouhani to deliver on that. But the broader point, I guess, is about the IRGC and their apparent silence in this, and the fact that you suggested maybe the Supreme Leader told them to cool it. That, nevertheless, the real – I don't know whether you saw that op-ed, that article recently in the New York Times by – the leader of the bus drivers union, or one of the leaders of the bus drivers union in Tehran, who has been tortured and his relatives have been brutalized and tortured and imprisoned by this regime and by the IRGC, and that element in that lawless element, if you will, in Iranian society. How do you, you know, expunge that element? I mean, the torturers and the jailers and the ones that murder their fellow citizens, if they see their power being taken away from them, they're likely to get more brutal. And after all, the IRGC gets a lot of – they control a lot of the oil sales, don't they?
Regrettably, you are right in all aspects. And the extensive torturing and intimidating that exists against the opposition or perceived opposition in Iran is pervasive. And I don't see any end to it at any time soon, especially by the involvement of Iran in Syria and Lebanon and all that. Excuse me. And that spurs a lot of growth in the type of people that was explained in the bus drivers union's leader. And Iran, unfortunately, is driven today. And many of the leaders in Iran today come from the war, from torture chambers. Look, the favorite candidate of President Ahmadinejad, Mr. Mashayi, himself was a torturer, and his wife actually was one of his victims that relinquished her political religious creed and then fell in love with the torturer, and eventually they got married. So this is a very macabre and dark picture, and I don't think that Rouhani can do a whole lot about it, frankly. The culture of torture and harassment is a part of this regime. But maybe in certain areas, like the continuous offense against women on the streets by the government, the continuous harassment of women because their cover of their hair is not complete, the harassment of young people for wearing T-shirts or whatever. Maybe he can do something about these things, but as I said, the culture of torture, of harassment, and executions and lawlessness is so embedded in this regime that it needs a whole lot stronger man than Rouhani to sponge it off.
Well, you were saying earlier, Rasul Nafisi, that the U.S. Congress is hardline and heavily influenced by the Israel lobby. I mean, you didn't say that, but I'm saying that, and that's obvious. And the Israeli Prime Minister, of course, has basically treated this elevation of this new leader with a great deal of skepticism. But surely, though, even if the president reaches out and encourages dialogue, and if the P5 plus one encourages dialogue, and if this new leader does what he did before, which is suspend enrichment in exchange for some kind of a deal, wouldn't the easing of sanctions by the rest of the world, short of the United States, make a great deal of difference? Because that was the question I had with Ali Arouzi, which is, how do you fix the Iranian economy without getting rid of the sanctions?
Absolutely. I mean, this is impossible. And unfortunately, the two messages of Ayatollah Khamenei before the election were both about resistance against the West and continuing with the present policy of enrichment. And I certainly hope that Rouhani can convince him, as I said before at the beginning of our talk, that there is a need for compromise and this and that. And then, assuming that he succeeds, I don't know how much U.S. Congress would get along. And then, assuming that even a U.S. government come along, and you mentioned Europe, and I understand that, of course, Europe would be very important in releasing sanctions on Iran and buying 60% of its oil from Iran and all that. I understand that's very, very important. But the final say actually rests here in Washington. And to me, if I could, I don't want to be pessimistic, but I really see this a very, very hard process, and I don't invest a lot of hope on quick solutions, and I just hope that in the first year, Rouhani can have a track record of saying, look, I did this, I did that. For example, one very simple thing that they can do is to go to the Supreme Leader and say, sir, now I am in place, I'm a moderate, I have a lot of votes, I am much better liked than Mousavi and others in the country. Why don't you release these guys? Let them go home. They are not important anymore. Let them go be with their families. And that would be a wonderful thing, and also show the sign of certain understanding between the government and the people.
Well, so, Rasul Nafisi, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Rasul Nafisi, who is an academic and Middle East expert. His latest book is The Rise of the Pasdaran, a monograph on the social, political, and economic roles of the Guardian. And his most recent book is The Culture of the Middle East. He contributes to Jane's Islamic Digest and Jane's Intelligence Digest. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the English language spokesperson for the Syrian opposition about the Obama administration's change of direction in supplying arms to the rebels. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rafif Shujati, who's the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. A Syrian-American activist, she works to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. Rafif has recently been in Turkey and the liberated area of Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Shujati.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And what is the what are you hearing from your colleagues in the opposition about the apparent change in U.S. policy, that the acknowledgement that the red line over the use of chemical weapons has been crossed. First, France came forth with what they considered to be solid evidence that up to 150 people had died with a limited use of chemical weapons, and now the U.S. has verified that and has changed its policy and is now talking about sending arms to the Free Syrian Army. So what's the response from the Free Syrian Army that you've heard so far?
Well, what we're hearing from Syrians in general, not just the Free Syrian Army, is that this is a welcome shift in policy, but it needs to be more than just talk. As we've seen with the Obama administration, they have declared their support for the opposition, but have not done much in the past to shift the balance of power on the ground. So now what we're looking for is a decisive victory and not a stalemate.
Well, the president himself is getting some unusual advice, which may be a little uncomfortable, from former President Bill Clinton, who just this week was talking about the continuing civil war in Syria and comparing it to his decision to intervene in Kosovo in 1999. President Clinton went on to say that he believes that Mr. Obama could end up looking like a total wuss if he doesn't intervene. What's your sense of, since you're a Syrian-American, in terms of American politics, do you detect any willingness on the part or any enthusiasm on the part of Americans to get involved?
Well, let me start by saying that we in the opposition do not characterize this as a civil war. We see this as a popular uprising that the Assad regime is trying to crush by sheer brute military force. With regard to U.S. policy, I don't think any American is enthusiastic about entering another war. And at the same time, I don't believe the Syrian opposition is asking for American boots on the ground or a protracted engagement. What we are asking for is defensive weapons and some mechanism by which to stop the Russian MiG from dropping bombs in civilian areas.
So what is your explanation, Refus Shahjati, for the reversals on the battlefields? Is it entirely to do with Russian MiGs or Hezbollah, who intervened in this recent battle over the key town of Qusair?
Well, I think it's a number of things. First of all, you're seeing an increased presence of Hezbollah forces on the ground. And of course, we in the opposition have been reporting this for more than a year. You're seeing increased Iranian influence separate from Hezbollah in Syria. You're seeing additional shipments of heavy weapons from Russia. And of course, you're seeing a death toll that tops 93,000 by UN estimates, with the knowledge that the actual death toll is much, much higher. So you have a humanitarian crisis, you have something that can be termed genocide going on, and you have an escalating military buildup by people who are not friends of the United States.
Well, there has to be something else to explain the fact that Assad is still in power, though, surely. He must have some support within the country. It can't simply be that foreign forces and foreign weapons are keeping him in power, surely.
Well, I would say that when he is free to bomb neighborhoods, civilian neighborhoods, and his air force is free to roam the country, I would say that's pretty decisive in tipping the balance. Now, I'm sure he does enjoy some support on the ground, but I believe that any supporters he has left are supporters simply because they have economic interests or they're afraid of the unknown of what comes after Assad. And while that is certainly a legitimate fear, we have to work to make sure that what comes after Assad is the kind of Syria we started the revolution for in the first place, which is a free, democratic Syria in which all Syrians can live in dignity.
And again, I'm speaking with Refus Shahjati, who's the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committee, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. She's a Syrian-American activist who works to empower other activists to take action to inform the public about events in Syria. And she's recently been in Turkey and the liberated areas of Syria. So if indeed what we're hearing now, that what the Obama administration plans to do in terms of supplying arms are nothing particularly radical, certainly not anti-aircraft weapons, not anti-aircraft missiles, more small arms and ammunition is what we're hearing so far. Now, Senator McCain is saying that the U.S. doesn't have to employ its air force to police a no-fly zone. They can send in cruise missiles and crater the runways. What would the Syrian opposition want from the United States at this point to tip the balance? And then once you've tipped the balance, what's the next step? I mean, what's the end game here?
Well, for us, the end game has always been the removal of the Assad regime, not the dismantling of state institutions, but the removal of the seat of power, which is the Assad regime. Sending ammunition and light arms is not going to create the kind of decisive victory that's needed for Syria to go back to something that resembles a state. Small ammunition will not radically shift the balance of power. It will simply prolong what is a bloody, bloody conflict that is claiming the lives of thousands of civilians.
So what about Senator McCain's suggestion then of U.S. getting involved without boots on the ground but by lobbing cruise missiles? And presumably the Russians won't be happy about that, and the U.S. and Russia may find themselves in a proxy war. Does this explain why the Obama administration has been hesitant that as soon as you start escalating, that it may turn into a proxy war and not, as you're saying, it's not a civil war, but as a war of liberation?
Well, many in the opposition would argue that it already has become a proxy war. And perhaps this does explain the Obama administration's hesitation to more fully support the opposition. However, the United States needs to work more closely with Russia, and the two governments need to understand that while they may or may not be discussing a proxy war, the bottom line is that hundreds and thousands of civilians are being affected, millions are displaced, and by UN estimates, more than half the population of Syria is in some form of need. This is a humanitarian catastrophe that has to transcend any geopolitical strategic interest at the time.
So what about McCain's suggestion then? Would the Syrian opposition welcome that? And what would it do in terms of the military balance? Because my understanding is that now the Assad regime is emboldened by its recent victory in Qusair and that they're moving on Aleppo now.
Right. So any military support can put an end to Assad's control of the skies. I think if we can secure the skies, then the ground battle is reasonably easy. If we can also put a stop to the Hezbollah fighters coming in. So the key thing here is to control the skies.
But what would stop Hezbollah coming in? There's obviously the border with Lebanon, the area where Qusair is right near that border. What can be done to stop Hezbollah? They seem to be determined. The Iranians are determined. The Russians are determined. The difference in this war in terms of the proxies is that the Assad supporters seem to be fairly determined to support him, whereas the Western supporters of the Free Syrian Army are ambivalent.
Well, that's exactly right. And so far, only those supporting Assad have been determined. I think now that the Western community is growing in its determination, I think that may be enough to tip the balance. I suspect that many of the Hezbollah fighters who are streaming across the border will be less likely to do so when they know that the United States and France and the United Kingdom and other Western powers are now actually determined to put an end to this.
So when you mentioned a little while ago that the U.S. and the Russians should be cooperating and negotiating, you and the opposition support efforts to bring about this conference in Geneva that seems to be continually delayed?
Well, of course, we would always welcome any sort of political process where the goal is to put an end to the killing and the suffering of civilians. We would all welcome a peaceful transition. I think, however, the Assad regime has proven time and again with multiple international initiatives that it is incapable of negotiating in good faith. It is incapable of responding to popular demands for the regime to step down. And I believe they have tried to pull the wool over the eyes of the international community. I will remind you of the Arab League initiative, followed by the Kofi Annan initiatives, where the Assad regime violated the tenets of those agreements before the ink was dry. So we don't believe that the Assad regime can negotiate itself out of a job in any sort of good faith.
Well, but according to the Syrian constitution, the current term of President Assad expires in May of 2014. Would that be an opportunity?
Certainly, if the regime has not collapsed before then, this would be another opportunity. But it's important for people to understand that voting in Syria is not like voting in the United States or in France. In Syria, your vote is yes or no, the yes or no being for the single candidate that is presented. And in about 98% of cases, those who vote no have suffered the consequences of that no vote. So this is not a democratic process to begin with.
So, Rafif Jujadi, again, English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. What is the significance of the Egyptian government breaking off diplomatic relations with the Assad regime?
Well, this is very significant in that now the Arab countries are taking more decisive action against the Assad regime and further stripping it of any legitimacy. So this is, of course, a welcome move.
And in terms of this red line being crossed in the use of chemical weapons, what's your understanding then from the point of view of the Free Syrian Army, who are on the receiving end of these limited attacks? What's your understanding of the Assad regime's logic of using them? Were they testing the West? Or?
Well, we've been reporting use of chemical weapons for well over a year. We saw initial reports of chemical weapons used in Homs and Zabadani, one of the Damascus suburbs. This is about a year and a half ago, and we have been providing evidence to the international community. So I'm glad they have finally come around and looked at the evidence. I believe that the Assad regime has been playing with chemical weapons for more than a year because that red line was so tenuous. I think they have been pushing that red line further and further, and they finally reached a point where the Obama administration and the governments of France and the UK can say it has decisively been crossed.
Well, they've said it's been decisively being crossed, and one assumes that this is the time when the U.S. would take the gloves off because they warned that this was the red line. But so far, the response from the U.S. in terms of what they pledged to do for the Syrian opposition has only amounted to small arms and ammunition. There is, however, a U.S. presence in Jordan and a number of F-16 aircraft that are deployed there, and there are special forces as well training Jordanians. So what do you know in terms of the Syrian opposition about any real help that might come your way?
I really can't speak to military operations taking place in Jordan. I can just say that if we were to receive the additional support, of course, this would be welcome because, again, for us, the end goal is to overthrow the Assad regime and restore stability to Syria.
And Is there stability within your own ranks, though, given that we've heard reports of frictions between the more secular opposition units and the al-Nusra Front, for example? And I think you have to admit that the Syrian opposition took a huge hit against them in terms of their credibility with the video of the officer, I think he was, talking about or even demonstrating eating the heart of one of Assad's soldiers. I mean, it's led Putin to make the remark that in terms of this negotiation that might happen in Geneva, that Putin said, I hope that the Syrian opposition doesn't send any organ eaters to the table. So it would seem to me that as shocking as some of the videos we've seen of what the Assad regime and the Shabia, their death squads, have done, this was pretty bad.
Oh, absolutely. There is no question that there are atrocities being committed by those who claim to be part of the Syrian opposition. Now, we in the LCC have not endorsed Jabhat al-Nusra or any of the Islamist groups by any stretch of the imagination. So we are committed to maintaining a secular state, and we have condemned all atrocities with equal passion. We do have to point out that the atrocities of the Assad regime outweigh by far any transgressions the armed opposition has undertaken. And nonetheless, we do condemn all of these acts. This is not what we signed up for, and this is not what our revolution is about. Our revolution is about freedom and dignity and democracy for all, and certainly organ eaters are not part of our equation.
Well, just in closing, Refif Shahjadi, assuming that there is more support from the U.S. and France and NATO for the Syrian opposition, what happens at the end of the day if Assad falls? What will the al-Nusra people do? Will there be another civil war or another war within a war?
I don't know that it would get to that. I think once we can overthrow the Assad regime and accomplish the original goal of the revolution, I think we can negotiate with al-Nusra Front. We can negotiate with other armed groups. And I think the actual jihadists will go on to their next jihad. I don't think they'll have any interest in staying in Syria. Keep in mind that overwhelmingly Syrians are secular in nature. We have many devout people from all religions, and we have traditionally lived together in peace and harmony and full respect for each other's belief. And I believe that we will go back to that once we eliminate the source of our problems, which is the Assad regime.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Refif Shahjadi.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Refif Shahjadi, who's the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition, a Syrian-American activist. She works to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. And she was recently in the area of Turkey and parts of Syria liberated by the Free Syrian Army. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.